Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
All right. So, like I said to some of you guys who've taken neuropharmacology, much of this is a rerun. So tonight, we're going to talk about drugs and hormones. Two things that affect behavior, affect the nervous system, but again, aren't neurotransmitters. Some of them are almost neurotransmitters. And if my mouse would ever associate with my computer, there it goes. Okay. So, what's a drug? It's a good question. Well, we all know what it means. But we're supposed to be doing science, so saying we all know what it means, I don't know. It's not good enough, right? We need a definition. At least we'd like one. This is one you see a lot in textbooks. It alters physiology, but it is not food. What about vitamin C? Friends together. Vitamin C, anybody? No? Okay, the graduation song? Okay, so she's clearly not a vitamin, or a C, or I don't know what she is. Anyway, remember that show, though, the one was like the fake American Idol, WB Superstar USA, where they convinced, she was one of the judges, they convinced really bad people they were good singers? It's on like 8 years ago. It was brilliant. It was the funniest. Anyway, they could never do it again, of course, because the cat's out of the bag. Anyway, vitamin C, I don't think we call that a drug, right? It's a vitamin, so it alters physiology. Then there's things that are also poisons that alter physiology and aren't food. A gasoline is one of them, right? Sniffing gas. Mugwort, which is just an herb, which will cause everything from really bad nightmares to spontaneous abortion. So that's altering. And also in big doses, that just kills you dead. So, okay, that's poison. We like calling those poisons. Maybe we don't need a definition. the problem is, it's hard to get one. The other thing is, even if we all agree what a drug is, we could say the alcohol, cocaine, whatever. What if you take it not to treat anything or to have any psychoactive effect? Right? And I mean Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola has caffeine in it. Right? You ever just drink a Coke? Or Pepsi? Right? You're not doing this for the physio, or maybe you are. Are you doing this to stay awake? Or are you just, yeah. I'm boring you? Is that what it is? That's pretty sad, really. Because you're, since last class, oh, that one, well, clearly that one. Is that the one with the geography? Yeah, that was boring. But typically, or if you have a cup of coffee in the morning, that's one thing. But what if you ever just go out for a coffee? It's a social thing. You say, let's go for a coffee. There's caffeine in it. What about a beer? That would be an excellent idea, wouldn't it? Before I left for work, I put about 9 beers in the fridge because I think I'll be thirsty when I get home. Now, the first one will be just because I'm thirsty. The other 8, they're just for fun while I watch Tora, Tora, Tora in my backyard, which is really what I'm going to do. But you ever go out just for a beer? You're not going out to get hammered. You're not even going out to just relax. It's like someone says, smoking for a beer? Yeah, let's go for a beer. Right? So you're not drinking it there for, and these clearly don't, you can take caffeine to treat a headache. By the way, here's a pro tip. If you ever get stuffed up nose, brew a pot of coffee. The action of brewing coffee because of classical conditioning will help clear your sinuses. And I'm not kidding. It's just simple learning. If you smell a pot of coffee, if you just open coffee up and smell it, if you can smell a little bit, it'll clear your sinuses because caffeine has that effect. See, I hand these things out. This is value added. Frankly, an intuitive definition is going to have to do, which makes me angry, but it's life. So we're just going to talk about different classes of drugs tonight. A couple things, and I'll talk a little bit about how they work, obviously. The chemical names of drugs. Here's my favorite all-time chemical name for a drug. Well, it's the only one I know. 7-chloro-1... Well, it's not true. Methanol. Ethanol. There you go. 7-chloro-1-3-dihydro-1-methyl-5-phenyl-2-H-1-4-benzodiazepine-2-1. Now, even the people that are bio majors in here, does that help anybody? Probably not. That's it. Oh, there's a picture of it, though. So, I mean, yeah, that doesn't help me either. That's a, you know, very, it's actual size. It's a big drug. That's kidding. It's not very helpful, is it? Generic names are good. That's diazepam. And diazepam, or hey, okay, that's diazepam, this thing here. Another one's fluoxetine, which is one you may not have heard of. Those, the trade names for those with capital letters are Valium and Prozac. You'll see in papers, if those of you take it and you do your paper, if you want to write it about something about a drug effect, and a couple of you have sent me your papers, please send me your papers in advance so I can say they're okay. So do you have, by the way. A couple of you sent me drug ones. You'll take and take note, they never use trade names. They never use trade names. Because unless it's a clinical trial, and no one's going to read a clinical trial. No one reads those. They're no fun. But, you know, you want to use the generic name. Why did that happen? Okay. So that's just some general stuff. Dosages of drugs. Different dosage sizes have different effects on different people and different animals. Right? Especially if they weigh different amounts. Not saying much here. I think I could drink young Stephanie here under the table. I just think I probably can. Yeah, okay. Ken Herndon, ladies and gentlemen. Our library, our university librarian and his daughter always said, I want to go to one of your classes. I said, feel free. Smartest guy in the university. Serious. They weigh different amounts. Well, second. No, I think he probably is the smartest guy around. So, like I said, I can probably drink more than Steph. We have to standardize the amount. So one drink to me means a lot less than it does, say, to Stephanie, I imagine. We standardize this in milligrams per kilogram, milligrams of drug to kilogram of body mass. And if those of you, again, using drug studies, you'll probably see this used, milligrams per kilogram. There are other ones. You will see millimoles per liter for solutions, millimoles per gram. But typically milligrams per kilogram is the one that's used. Okay, what we're going to see, we want to see a drug effect, right? We want to see how does some drug affect the nervous system and affect behavior, right? Brain behavior. We have to have some variable for a response. You know, so, and then we plot the response, the score on the variable, as a function of the dose. So, for example, one drink and I'm relaxed. One drink is enough that, you know how one drink, it's nice. You have one drink, it relaxes you. It's that nice sort of calming feeling. And then there's a strange effect where you get four drinks, so you get a little silly, a little tipsy, a little crazy, a little wacky. You know, you might start singing karaoke. It takes more than four to get me singing karaoke. You might, guys, you might what? Dance, right? At that point, that's when you might, maybe you might consider, you're at a wedding with your girlfriend or your wife, and she says, oh, we want to dance, and you always look at her and say the same thing. I'm really not drunk enough yet. I don't know how women just dance, right? Guys are like, well, I really need a few drinks. I'm not, no. So, and we'll talk about alcohol because it's weird, because it's a depressant, yet it has this weird effect on you. We'll talk about that tonight. And then, after eight, I'm pretty relaxed again. In other words, I'm kind of, you know. This is actually a very common shape in a dose response curve. This is really quite common. What you get is a small effect, okay? And then you get this big effect here, and then it goes back the other way. Or we could make it go like this, be inverted like that. If we're measuring relaxation, the curve looks like a U. If we're measuring arousal, I guess you'd call it, we could measure something here like how loud your voice is, actually. Your voice gets louder when you drink. And that's a measurable thing. It would be like this, upside down parabola, right? Pretty common shape, and I can show you that here. If you look at this curve on the left, it's probably the most instructive one. Here we have activity level. This is a pretty easy thing to measure, actually. It's in rats. You put them on a... Is it rats or are they mice? I do believe those are mice, actually. Yes, because those are... Yeah, those strains of mice. So you take these mice and you have them on a board like this. Okay? And you have little photo beams. You see how many times they break the beam. It's just them running around. It's a way to standardize activity level. Here we're giving morphine, milligrams per kilogram. And you see activity is, well, with none, that's sort of your baseline. Then it goes up, up, up. And then they're strung out in the corner. Right? On the other hand, by the way, if you take a look, this is morphine. Okay? This group here is given morphine and naloxone. Naloxone, if you remember, is a morphine antagonist. Note how their effect is pretty straight. It's pretty flat. So they aren't strung out at the end there. They're just, morphine's not doing anything to them. The figure on the right shows roughly the same thing. And this is from nose poke. What is nose poke? And this is, that one is in rats. Yeah. No, that's mice too. I think I read that paper. That's mice too. It's actually the mouse poking its nose at a little hole. They're just looking around. So you put a little photo beam in there and measure how many times they poke their nose into a hole. Okay. So again, you see that curve looks like this. Very, very common. All right? Yeah, Dan. Oh, sorry. It looked like you were asking a question. Well, when the hell didn't you ask it last term? Damn you. Okay. So you understand the idea of a dose response curve? There's a lot of different variables you could use.
Is that saying there's a crash, basically?
Not really, because what you got with a crash is it's more of a withdrawal symptom. It's afterwards. Here, what's done, I'll go back. For example, here, these guys here with the solid bars are so, they're basically, in essence, strung out. Because this is what, these are all different groups of animals. This group has been given 20, rather. Yeah, let's look at these guys. Yeah, so now here we've got, can't read that. I can't read the damn legend. Anyway, it's got more than 20 milligrams per kilogram. These guys have been given none. There's no activity here. But the reason there's no activity here is because they've got so much drug in their system. It's like if I right now made you drink 8 beers, just one after the other, in about 10 minutes, you'd be flat on the floor. In fact, you might be dead. Because 8 beers at once will do bad things to you. Or just give you a bottle of gin and said, Joe, drink it. And we all start going, chug it, chug, chug. And of course, you know what guys are like. Oh, okay. Believe me, I'd do it too. This isn't disparaging your character.
How would there be no activity going on if I drank that?
No, I'm saying once the drug effect is kicked in, so in say, 10 minutes, you wouldn't have that part. You'd never get to the part of, oh, yeah, this is great. I'm having fun. Let's dance and sing karaoke. You'd be going, boom. So it wouldn't be like a crash like after, say, taking speed, which takes place after you take the drug, after you've had the high. This is a big dose at once. That's the difference. So if a crash is like a crash and run kind of phenomenon with speed where you just, well, run and crash actually. So you take speed, like meth, take meth. And then finally, either you run out of meth, or you just stop, and then eventually you fall asleep. That's the crash. So that's a different effect altogether. Yeah, it's a withdrawal symptom.
It's kind of almost like a plateau.
Yeah, ish. Yeah, you can think of it that way. Yep. Can't do anything else. If you gave him any more, like I can't give you any more drinks than would make you pass out. I could do by IV. That'd be pretty mean. But I mean, you know, something like that, right? Other questions, by the way? That's a good question. Okay. Describing the effectiveness of a drug, we can talk about the ED50 and the LD50. And again, some of you guys, I know, are using drug papers for your article comparisons, so you'll see these terms. The ED50 is the effective dose for 50% of the population. It's with psychoactive drugs. This is subjective. How many beers do you need to feel it? How much THC do you need to have a buzz going? Things like that. THC is the stuff in marijuana. The good stuff. It's subjective. But even really for like a pain medication, this is subjective. Because I'm asking you to tell me when doesn't it hurt anymore. This isn't the same as, I don't know. Penicillin. So you start to see the infection going away. There's your ED50 for to 50% of the population. That's not subjective. We can just look at that and measure it. With a psychoactive drug, we tend to be talking about something where we ask people, are you high? You know? Or even, like I said, if it's a painkiller, is this killing pain? Right? Now, the LD50, that's not subjective. It's the ultimate dependent variable. It's the lethal dose for 50% of the population. This is what kills you. We tend to get this from reports of overdoses in animal studies because people don't sign up for that. There's a little ethical issue. Okay? So we can then get what's called the therapeutic index of a drug. We take the LD50, divide by the ED50. The higher the index, the safer the drug. Okay? So if you take a look at a drug like... Now, let's go with Delta-9 THC, the active ingredient in marijuana. It's virtually infinite. It is impossible to overdose on THC.
Even in brownie mixture?
Yeah. It's very hard to overdose on it. Let's even go one better. LSD. You can't take too much LSD that'll kill you. You can take so much LSD you do something very stupid. But that's a drug effect on your behavior, but that's not the drug killing you. However, so it's virtually infinite. On the other hand, you could take the therapeutic index for alcohol is about 5, which should scare the shit out of you. Because that means 5 times the amount you take to feel good in the same amount of time will kill you. Heroin's around there too. In fact, it's probably a little higher. Heroin's actually probably technically a safer drug than alcohol. The difference is, of course, you have to buy heroin from very, very bad people. Really bad one here, lithium chloride, which you take for the manic part of bipolar affective disorder. Therapeutic index around 3. You'd be really careful if you're taking lithium. And those of you that maybe have bipolar or know somebody who's taken it, know that they're doing blood work on you constantly. Higher the index, the safer the drug. Okay. Yeah, please.
Dave, do you have to specify exactly what you tested on? Because I was reading MSD sheets and it says LD50 for like rats or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, typically that's what's done because there's really, like I said, there's hardly any way to do this without, except for reports of overdoses. And then all you do is you get, and again, you have to then get the amount in the blood, but you really have to know how much they were taking at each time. So typically it's done in rats or in monkeys sometimes, but usually rats. Okay. Potency and efficacy, or effectiveness. Find the ED50 for both drugs. In other words, where does it work? Let's think about a pain medication here.
Fentanyl.
Okay. Or OxyContin. Get something fun. Fentanyl's fun, too. Yeah, that's right. And compare it to aspirins. They both kill pain, don't they? But you don't need as much, say, OxyContin as you do ASA to kill pain. Same thing here we could do. So the one with the lower ED50 is more potent. Okay? Efficacy, or the effectiveness, is about the maximum amount of effect the drug will have. And again, we can go with, I think the example I have up here is morphine and Tylenol or something like that. Morphine versus aspirin, rather. No matter how much aspirin I give you, if you just had surgery, it's not going to get rid of, if you've had like an appendectomy and they've cut your stomach open, and they cut your gut open, right? And I'm sure people in here have had appendectomies as adults even. While it's a simple operation, it's still an operation. It still has to cut you open, right? So because of that, it hurts. Because they cut you open. They don't give you, now, a few days later, they'll give you ibuprofen or they'll give you... Why can't I think of the one that's in Tylenol? Acetaminophen, thank you. Or acetylsalicylic acid. But at first, they give you morphine. Right? Or codeine. Because it kills more pain. Right? Okay. Questions so far? I got to get some of that stuff out of the way because we'll talk about these things.
Would you mind doing a practice example? Or if you have time for it?
How do you mean?
Dividing the lethal dose.
Yeah, sure. Let's think about something. Good idea. So let's say something like, well, let's go with alcohol. It's pretty simple because it's around 5. So the blood alcohol level that's legal, right, is in fact roughly where it actually has an effect on you, which is 0.05, right? It will have an effect on you. But if you ever blow a 1.0, that's really drunk. Like, most of us, it's really... look, I've been around breathalyzers. Because when you're a graduate student and you see neuroscientists around, there's breathalyzers in labs, and you decide, let's see who can blow the highest. That's the kind of thing you do in graduate school. And it was hard to drink enough to blow a 1. It's hard to do. It can be done. And I think many of us probably have done it.
But that's all built into tolerance.
Oh, no, sure. But the blood, yeah, sure it is. But let's even all that out. Let's just imagine that's not there. So if you blow a 1, you're hammered. So let's say it's about a 0.08. Okay? Now, we know that it's 5 for the therapeutic index. Right? And I'm using blood alcohol level here instead of milligrams per kilogram. But in fact, it's just a simple mathematical transformation. And we all know about 0.05. 0.08 used to be the legal limit. And you're feeling it at 0.08. You can feel 0.08. I'm glad they put the legal limit down to 0.05. Because 0.08 is enough that you can feel like you've been drinking. So, what we have to get to the point where it kills you. What? Right? So it's 5 times 8. What is that? 40, right? So we're going to get to 0.40. That's going to be the lethal dose. Now, to blow a 0.4 is hard. But you could do it just as you die, because... But you'd have to have drank the same amount. To blow a 0.08, you probably have had about, let's say... You know the rule of thumb that I always use, 1 beer an hour, and that really is closer to the 0.05 thing. It's probably closer to about, let's say, 2.5. It's probably closer to that. Okay? So 2.5 times 5 means in that same hour, instead of drinking, say, 2.5 beers, I'm talking about for a guy who's about my size, about 185 pounds, okay? You would have had to have drank 2 times 5, 10, and then half of 5, 15 beers in an hour. That will kill you. That would kill you. The average you. Okay? So remember when you were in high school and you did stupid things like drinking things like shotgunning and funneling and all that stuff, and we all giggle and laugh. Yeah, we all could have killed ourselves. I'm just saying. You ever do the one where you take the drink and you put the alcohol in, and then you put like a shirt on top of it, and then you pour mix on top of it, like some kind of pop in the alcohol? Or so you put the mix at the bottom, alcohol on top, and the mix floats. Or so the alcohol floats because it's lighter. And glasses, just simple physics, pour from the bottom. So if you do it in shots, all you taste is the pop. We used to call those machines because it was like a drinking machine. It was like a drunk-getting machine. And you could drink, 12 of those in 10 minutes. You can kill yourself doing that.
You actually sell, special glasses that you make
them. Oh, I know. I know. It's amazing. It's one of the most dangerous drugs available, and it's legal. And believe me, I'm not going to preach about prohibition ever of anything. I just don't think that's for grown-ups. Put on your body what you want. Just don't get behind the wheel of a car. That's all I ask. Or go to work. But it's a weird drug it's weird. If we started all over today, if we decided to restart society, we'll have to do that after 2012 when the Mayan calendar says the world ends. We'll probably say, yeah, alcohol is illegal. Everybody get high because it's safer. Does that help you? So, yeah, so that's that kind of thing. Like, it's a lot, but it's enough that, people can drink that much, for example. Like, do it. And it's exceedingly dangerous. We can talk about primary effects versus secondary effects or side effects. Depends on your point of view. This is, again, completely subjective. If you're taking morphine to deal with pain, the main effect is the analgesia. And the... often, for many people, fun side effect is the high. So the only reason you're calling it a side effect is you're taking it because, say, it's post-surgery, If, on the other hand, as I say here, you're taking it because you want to groove to Quicksilver Messenger Service, it's a psychedelic band from the 60s. I just thought it goes well with heroin or something. Then the side effect, in fact, is the analgesia. And the main effect is, oh, man, my whole body's having an orgasm. And it has for the last 40 minutes, which makes you wonder why more people don't take heroin. Right? It's a good thing the kid left, eh? Yes, tonight's lecture, Ken, I'm going to tell your 4-year-old daughter is about drugs. Yeah. And orgasms, yeah. I would have to change my examples, because most of them are about orgasms. Yeah. Well, I'm going to talk about the nucleus accumbens. It's more key terms. Agonists and antagonists, we've talked about those. Great example here, the classic one, is opiates are basically chemically identical. So that's things like heroin, morphine, morphine and codeine, let's just say that. They're identical to endorphins, chemically. They open the ion channel. Naloxone is an opiate antagonist. It binds to the receptor without opening the ion channel, without causing that protein folding I was talking about the other day. Drugs have additive effects, so sometimes if you take drug X and drug Y, and let's invent some... Every week I say the same thing. I should get these out, and I don't. Threatening. So let's think about, I don't know, some measure of being, subjective measure of feeling kind of wasted, okay? So, and it's on a 10-point scale. I'm just making that up. Dave's 10-point scale of being wasted. So it could be that if you take drug A, which normally gives you 3 levels of wastedness, and drug B, which gives you 4, if the drug's effects are additive, you get, when you take an A and a B, you get 7. That's pretty rare. More typically, we get what are called super additive effects.
So you'd have to take 2 agonists to have the additive effect, though, right?
Well, they'd both be agonists, probably, if they're drugs. Yeah, more than likely. But they don't have to be. I mean, they could be antagonists, yeah. But let's pretend we're talking about something that's going to make us... loopy. And I mean, you could get loopy from all kinds of different things. One could be an agonist, one could be an antagonist, operating on different systems. If you had a GABA agonist, which would make you kind of slow you down, yeah, and you had a glutamate antagonist, because it's excitatory, they'd have the same effect, but they'd act differently physiologically.
Wouldn't weigh each other or numb each other out?
Well, that would only be because... Because when I said, remember, we had a glutamate agonist, that's going to calm you down. Sorry, a GABA agonist is going to calm you down. And a glutamate antagonist is also going to calm you down. Because it's blocking an excitatory neurotransmitter. Okay? Now, let's think about now, if A and B, I don't know what, I can't even think of 2 drugs that are just additive. It's very hard to think of 2 like that. But let's think of 2 that are super additive. Sleeping pills and martinis. You take a 3 and a 4 and you get about a 62. I'm just making up math there, but what I'm saying is if you take 1 Valium and 3 drinks, you can kill yourself. Like, you can just do yourself, or try cyclic antidepressants. A couple of those and a few drinks and you're dead. Phenobarbital and vodka. That's what the... Remember the Heaven's Gate people? Do you remember this? Maybe you don't. Maybe you're probably small children then. Damn you all. 1996, this cult decides what they're going to do is they're going to go to see a spaceship in a comet Hale-Bopp. Yeah. So they figured the way to do that is to take phenobarbital and vodka. It's not a good combination. They all died. They all died. But they all wore Nike shoes and purple sweatsuits. And those of us in this room that are old enough to remember that, I can see, well, yeah, I remember that. Then people made funny, funny posters that said, just do it, you know. Yeah, it's a little dark. It's a little dark. I didn't do it. I'm saying people did. A colleague of mine had that on his office door. I'm just saying. I'm not going to name who it is. But he does still work here. That's all I'm going to say. So that'll kill you. That's why you really be careful mixing drugs. I always say, I don't care what you take. No, don't get behind the wheel of a car and don't mix your drugs, please. You'll die. It's really dangerous. You shouldn't do that. And we'll talk about why a little later. This example here is a classic. So, you know, like things like a benzodiazepine, like Valium, and alcohol are really bad that way. Okay. How do you get drugs in? You can inject, usually with a, if you're injecting, you need a vehicle, and that vehicle is saline almost always. Right? So, you don't inject just, well, you can't inject a powder into your skin, into your veins. You have to dissolve it in something. So you can't just, like, heroin comes in a powder, in a handy-dandy powder form. But you can't just inject the powder. You got to put it in something. So you put it in saline, right?
Dave.
Yep.
You said that LSD and THC, they don't have a TI.
They basically don't. It's almost impossible to take it, have it to overdose.
I mean, if you mix them with something else, it's not...
No, it doesn't at all.
It still applies to
them. Yeah, be careful. Yeah. Yeah. I know. That wasn't you. No, I know. Well, I mean, I can pretty much tell you dropped acid before class. But no, I'm not saying it was about you. I was sort of just saying that to the gentle listener. Yeah.
Do you think that's because you can continuously absorb and use up by the body?
Sometimes it is that. Sometimes they do things called either enzyme induction or enzyme suppression. Whenever you are taking a drug, it has to... Part of it gets used up in your brain, but also part of it, it has to get broken down at some point. So you can pee it out, basically, typically, yeah. Right? One drug might block the enzyme production that is going to be one of the enzymes that helps break down the other drug. Right? So if I take drug A, and one of the things it does is not only does it have this fun psychological effect, it also blocks the enzyme... Okay. It breaks down drug B. It just suppresses it. So now drug B is going to be in your system longer because you can't break it down and pee it out. So that's one of the things that does happen. Yeah. Yeah, and it's insidious. Taking enzyme induction and enzyme... I just forgot the other word. No. Enzyme induction and enzyme... The opposite of... Suppression! Suppression. You went seven again. You had a tip in your tongue too? You're going,
yeah.
Okay, yeah. Enzyme suppression, enzyme induction. Sometimes, now this is, but the thing is, a lot of times the enzyme induction, even if you might think, oh, that's great, because it's going to break down, not all, very often, it'll induce an enzyme for another drug, but it's an enzyme that breaks down one of the enzymes in the metabolic pathway of drug B. So, very often, very rarely do drugs cancel each other out. Really, you have to, when you mentioned before about an agonist and antagonist, that's about the only time is when you can actually give a pure antagonist. And who takes a pure antagonist? I mean, they do that if you overdose on heroin, the first thing they do is they pump you full of naloxone because they want to stop the action of the heroin or any other opiate. So you need saline. Oh, you need subcutaneous just underneath the skin. That's your slowest absorption. You need intramuscular, right into a muscle, tends to be your thigh, right? Yeah. If you know people or somebody in here is diabetic, they often inject themselves in their thigh. Intraperitoneal, this is right into the gut cavity. This is, well, not quite the fastest absorption. It's not as fast as one we'll talk about in a moment, but it's pretty quick because you're bypassing everything, going right to the gut. So those three so far, that's the fastest. Intravenous, you can go right into a vein. Right? Find a vein, tie the tourniquet off, and shoot yourself up with some heroin. Oh, boy. Watch the movie Trainspotting. Intraventricular, you could go, yeah, right into the heart. Or you could go, you could go that way. Now again, that's not done. People don't do that recreationally.
What if they do, they have DR.
They still shouldn't do it recreationally. A lot of MDs have drug problems. When you carry around a bag full of painkillers. Yeah. In fact, a couple of buddies of mine that went to med school said one of the things they're warned about in ethics classes and stuff is you really have to realize that you've got a really big bag of fun there and don't play with it. They get into the bloodstream by diffusion, you know, just diffusion, except for IV injections, and intraventricular injections, obviously. Inhalation works roughly the same way. It could be gases and it could be burned solids. So smoke, right? And that's just going to get to the bloodstream and then to the brain. Remember how much of your brain is being, you got your oxygen and your glucose going to your brain. Well, it's also going to carry whatever you're smoking, for example. You can also take a drug orally, take pills, or just eat them. The more lipid-soluble something is, the easier it absorbs into your body. So, for example, something like heroin is very lipid-soluble. THC is lipid-soluble, which is why it's ideal to make cookies and brownies out of it, because you've got to put it in the butter. That's a lipid. Ionized molecules of the drugs are not absorbed, and the rate of absorption orally, the rate itself is constant. You're not going to get, usually, a quick rush from drinking alcohol, even, let's say, for example, or from eating hash brownies, right? Because you're not getting that quick hit. The rate is constant and slow. Yeah, but it's a whole different high. Yeah. So I'm told. Okay.
Are you saying that gases pass the blood-brain barrier?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, depending on the gas. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. All right. Once absorbed, the drug has to get past the blood-brain barrier. Here we are. It gets across the membrane. Through either passive or active transport. Passive transport is diffusion. Active transport, of course, you know, a transporter protein picks it up and actually pulls it across. Some of the drug gets proteins bind to it, so it actually then can't bind to the receptor site. That's going to happen. And it's taken out of the bloodstream by the kidneys and the liver, and you pee it out. And also, oftentimes, depending on the drug, alcohol, as you know, you breathe it out. Some of the alcohol, you actually exhale. Sweat, yeah. You'll sweat out alcohol as well. And you measure it in half-life. You measure how long is it the drug is in your system in half-life. So how long does it take for half of it to be gone? So if something has a half-life of 30 minutes, and you took 50 milligrams of the drug. In 30 minutes, you now have 25 milligrams still in you. In 30 more minutes, you now have 12.5 milligrams of the drug in you. See, now it's half of 25. In another 30 minutes, you have 6 1/4 milligrams of the drug in you. And I'm just dividing by 2 each time. Yeah, that's right. And then it's time to get the maintenance beers in you. I shouldn't have said beers, though, because alcohol doesn't work. Almost all drugs we measure in half-life. Right? So you excrete most of it at the very beginning. And then less and less and less and less. Just like, remember learning about radioactive half-life in, grade 12 chemistry? No? It didn't help anybody, did it? Okay. What affects the metabolism itself? Well, the age, usually older subjects, animals or non-human animals or us, there's going to be a difference there.
Dave, why is it usually with age, say an elderly person goes in and has the surgery, they definitely react differently than a younger person in that they wake up more confused?
Oh, right, yeah. Well, I mean, because usually that's just a metabolic thing. Their metabolism isn't as quick anymore.
Or they're having DTs.
Well, it could be that, too. I mean, that's an entirely different thing. And I mean, the other thing, of course, you can't absorb as much alcohol when you're older, but most of us, that's all else being equal. Most of us have built up tolerance over our lives to alcohol, so we actually can drink more than we could when we were 17. Right? But all else being equal, older people have more trouble than younger people, typically. It's just, you know, the body's like that. Just a machine, eh? The sex, so of course we got differences between the sexes. This often has to do with, in humans, with the amount of fat. Women have, on average, more body fat than men. But it also could have to do with say, hormones, conceivably. Species, so now we're going between species. We'll talk about caffeine tonight. All other animals metabolize caffeine differently than adult humans. Enzyme induction and enzyme, it's depression, not suppression. But we knew what it meant. So, and I was mentioning that basically sometimes a drug will make the body make more of an enzyme that helps break the drug down, or make the body stop making so much of that enzyme. But other things can do it too. Broccoli can affect caffeine absorption. It's crazy. Putting absorption and excretion together, you get the time course of a drug, and that's what this is. So look, this is the absorption curve up here. Here's the excretion curve here. You take this curve, and you subtract that curve, and you get this one. Okay?
How do you do that?
Oh, it's just mathematical. It's just like, that's positive, that's negative. This function, subtract this function. Yep. It's just taking a function and subtracting another function. It's just math. But you can see here, so it says up here, and then down here it goes down. See what we have here then is we get this nice peak here, and then we slowly have less and less of the drug. Now, what you want to do typically is maintain enough drug in the system. This could be, by the way, because you want to stay high. This could be, however, because you want to have some psychoactive effect on, say, schizophrenia. Okay? So you want to maintain a nice steady level. If the drug has a long time course, so the longer that time course, right, the longer that curve, the easier it is to maintain a stable level. Because if it goes up and then zoom right back down, it's going to be hard to keep a constant level. And that should say shorter. Damn it. It's harder if the time course is shorter. And that would be something like it's absorbed very quickly and then excreted very quickly. It's going to be very hard to maintain a steady level of the drug. Right? All right. Follows? Okay. So that's just some background on drugs. Some general stuff. Talk a bit about drug taking behavior itself. I don't want to dwell on this too much, but when people first thought about it, and until very relatively recently, drug taking just seemed odd. You're not avoiding pain, right? It doesn't affect all people the same way. Think about alcohol. Most people, vast majority of people, can drink and not devote their lives to alcohol. Right? And yes, I know you could give me a whole thing about drowning your sorrows or your psychic pain. That's not what I mean. Okay? And you don't need alcohol, though I could really go for a cold beer right now. But you can live without it. But some people end up having real trouble with alcohol or heroin or marijuana, or we can go on and on. So the original idea was that obviously just showed you had a lack of like moral fiber. You're just a lowlife and a loser. So, and a lot of people probably still think that about people that do drugs. Right? Even people that do recreational drugs and don't have a problem with it, frankly. Right? But when you hear the word alcohol, like a lot of us think the same thing. Ooh, Luther. Right? No, really, people think that. I didn't say it was fair. I didn't say it was correct. I'm saying people think that. They think, oh, God, that guy's been, you know, falling asleep in his own vomit on the street. Things like that, you know. And a lot of alcoholics aren't like that at all. They just have a real problem with alcohol. So we reject that. That's silly. So what about it being a disease? So it's not about your character. That's good. Or your morality. And you like, and most people like the disease model. Yeah. It's a disease, or I guess a disorder. We can't call things diseases anymore. It's against the law. What's the difference between disease and disorders? Anybody know? Anybody ever define that? Anybody get the memo or the email about that? I just want to know what it is. That's all.
Okay.
I'm serious. I'd love to know. Okay, so maybe it's a disorder or a disease. Started with this study, it started with alcoholism, right?
It could mean that disease is like a fleshy disease, and whereas a disorder is a mental disorder.
Maybe. Yeah, that sounds okay. Then again, is diabetes a disease or a disorder?
Disease.
Okay. Is autism a disease or a disorder?
Disorder.
Okay, it's a disorder.
But my understanding was that dis-ease is anything that caused the body to be at dis-ease, literally. But a disorder is
conceivable.
Causing the mind to be reacting like...
Yeah, that sounds like a distinction without a difference to me.
Wouldn't the disease be something accidental in the body?
That's a nice try. What'd you say, Kurt?
Could a disease be something external affecting the body? And a disorder could be like MS, like something internal affecting the body.
Yeah, but isn't MS a disease?
Well, it's a dysfunction of the body. Itself.
Oh, don't bring another dis word into it, Kurt. Because you're screwing up the whole system now. No, see, this is the thing. I mean, this is totally a side issue, but yeah, go ahead. You got an idea? Oh, you're doing this? I thought you had an idea. Okay, how's it going? I don't know. I don't know why I even mentioned this. It's just odd. I don't know. It just bugs me. I don't know. I don't really care. It doesn't affect me.
See, I think disease would be like cancer. But
fair enough. Nobody would say cancer is a disorder. That's right. Everybody here would go, yeah, it's a disease.
Whereas you wouldn't say someone has autism is a disease. That would be just wrong.
Why?
Because it's a disorder.
That's not an answer, man. Yeah, I just don't know. That's all. It just bothers me. And then we get these... Why don't we just have one word? And stick with it. I don't know. Anyway, what's the disease mechanism for alcoholism? I don't know. Now, I'm not saying because we don't know a disease mechanism, it can't be a disease. How does it work? But we really have no idea. So, for addictions in general. So that's a good question, because a lot of money's been poured at this. And people will tell you, well, it's genetic. And in fact, there's a lot of truth to that. If your brother is an alcoholic, you're also more likely to be alcoholic, like a twin brother, say homozygotic or monozygotic twin, rather than dizygotic twin. So identical versus fraternal twins. There's data there. There's no argument about that. But so is your eye color genetic. We don't call that a disease, or do we now? Or is that a disorder? I don't know. Or a dysfunction. So, who cares? It's genetic, right? I'm not saying it's not an important thing to worry about, but the genetic thing doesn't make a disease. What? What is a disease? I don't know the answer, man, so I can't put something on I don't know the answer to. I don't think there's an answer to that. I wish somebody would tell me, though. Who would know?
Call him Farrell.
Yeah, I don't know. Regis. I bet Regis knows somehow. I don't know why. I just think he probably knows. Is that your final answer? That is very close, by the way, to my Larry King impression. They're almost identical. Okay, physical dependence. The original idea was that with morphine was that, you know, morphine withdrawal is kind of ugly. So maybe morphine makes your body make a toxin, a poison called autotoxin. Okay? It's automatically made. That's also, by the way, the name of my autotoxin. It's the name of my heavy metal band I was in the 80s. No, I'm kidding. I just love saying stuff like that. It'd be a great name for a band. It's like Anthrax. Yeah. Great name for a band. So this is the idea. And then people looked for it, and there wasn't any autotoxin. But then they said, well, so... So the idea of physical dependence, your body actually needing it, came up. And people stuck with that. They liked it. It's a very popular idea. You put physical dependence model and disease model together, and you've got what 95% of medical doctors would say. You know, and a lot of other people, too. This accounts also nicely for the abnormality of it, doesn't it? It's your body doing it, and it's a disease. Put those two together. Oh, I'm sorry, or a disorder, or a dysfunction, or dysthymia. That's not it at all. That's minor depression, isn't it? That's good. Counts for the abnormality. But like I said, put that together with the disease model, and you got the way most humans think. Okay. Now, originally this was only depressants could make autotoxin. Nothing, by the way, nothing makes autotoxin. There's no such thing as autotoxin. But then it turned out that things that other than depressants, like say, cocaine, can give you. You can get hooked on cocaine, right? So Tatum and Seaver, see how old this model is? 1931 said also the habit forming aspect. It's a habit, so they throw that in there. See, for stimulants, though, don't produce withdrawal symptoms nearly as intensely as depressants. Do people have withdrawal from cocaine and meth and that? Yeah, sure they do. But it's not nearly the same as withdrawal from heroin or alcohol. Right. So you got no withdrawal. First of all, there's no autotoxin. And, well, LSD, there's no withdrawals from LSD. There's hardly anything from marijuana. Yes, Steph?
Body stops making as many dopamine receptors.
You know, there may be something to that, except your body will then sort of readjust anyway, eventually. Yeah, yeah.
So would that be considered physical dependence?
Well, I mean, there's something going on there. There's a change. There's no argument there. But is that the reason you're taking the drug, though?
No.
That, yeah, exactly.
You didn't have that in the beginning.
No, exactly. That's exactly the point I was going to make. So, I mean, while there's an effect on the rest of your body, of course, and an effect on your nervous system. Yeah, long term sometimes, sure. But is that the reason you started? No. You know, it takes quite a bit of use before something like that. You stop making receptors, things like that. Good question. So here's a new idea, because this isn't working very well. Psychological dependence. You hear people say that one a lot, eh? The hard part to get over is the psychological dependence. When you need a drug, but you don't need a drug. So the need there is like Stephanie mentioned, you know, your body's not producing enough dopamine receptors. It's conceivable. This happens with some drugs. But maybe you don't need the drug anymore, physically, but you just need the drug, psychologically. Mind-body dualism. When you crave a drug, when do you crave a drug? Well, when you're psychologically dependent. When are you psychologically dependent on a drug? Well, when you crave it? Oh, wait a moment. Strikes me that's a little circular. So this model is no good either. Biggest problem here with this model is there's continued abuse of drugs that do not produce withdrawal. You can get addiction without dependence. Dependence is just getting withdrawal symptoms. So getting addiction without dependence, you can take enough of a drug every night and devote your life to it to get a little wasted, but not have withdrawal symptoms the next day. You could drink yourself silly and do stupid things. That's something to define as a drug problem. It interferes with your life, but not get a hangover any morning. That's a drug problem. You know, that's serious. You know, you don't hear your kid crying. Stuff like that. Do something stupid. But then the next day you can function. You don't have a hangover, nothing. That's a lot of alcoholics are like that.
But I mean, it's still an alcohol life.
Oh, the next morning? Yeah, sure, yeah, because alcohol's not... The excretion's pretty weird. So you're getting addiction without dependence. The best model, the one I like, and the one that is in the, when we talk about neurofarm class, is called the positive reinforcement model. People used to think you couldn't get animals addicted, and addicted just means, you know, habitual drug user, because they don't have moral problems, so they can't be immoral, or they can't get the disease because it's one of them human diseases, disorders, dysfunctions. Then they said, you know what we can do? We put a catheter right into their brain and have them work for the drug. So they push a little bar, little rats, they push a little bar and they get a shot of, I don't know, how about morphine? And Thompson and Schuster found out in 1964, rats will work for morphine. They will push the little bar to get morphine shot right into their brain. Ooh. Good on you, rats. You're all high and mighty with your little whiskers. I don't know. I'm really running out of stuff. I'm doing this job too long. I need a sabbatical. I do. I need a sabbatical just to think of new material. I doubt the dean would approve that sabbatical. I just need new jokes for my lectures, so I'm going to go off for a year. Pay me 85% of my salary, please. And I don't think they'd approve that one. How's this work? It seems circular, because I'm saying, when you take a drug, when it makes you feel good, when it's reinforcing. When does it make you feel good? When you take a drug. It sounds as bad as the psychological dependence model. The thing is here, we know from physiology, we have an operational definition. So we don't just have an operational definition of reinforcer, which is something that makes you do something more. What we have is we know the physiology. I've talked about the accumbens before. The dopamine hypothesis says, and it's pretty clear, that you go from ventral tegmental area to the medial forebrain bundle to the nucleus accumbens. When that circuit, which runs on dopamine, is fired, it feels good. You directly stimulate that circuit, you can get a rat to do anything in about 90 seconds. Typically, it would take, to train a rat to sit, say, right there and stay still. If you were doing that with food training, that might take you a couple hours. It'll take you 90 freaking seconds with direct brain stimulation of the accumbens. The closer they get, you just go, zzz, zzz, zzz. Then the rat's just sitting there going, oh yeah. Morphine to the ventricular gray, which is just part of your limbic system. This leads to dependence. This gives you the withdrawal symptoms. It's actually a little deeper in the limbic system. It's... Oh, where's the diagram on the test? I can show you. Why do I always forget to bring my brain model? Okay. Just above the brainstem. Okay. That's where the pain center is. That's where, like, not pain center, that's the where opiates are released. That's near your vomit center and your cough center, those kind of places, very basic functions. You give morphine there, it leads to dependence. You give it to nucleus accumbens, just to the accumbens, you don't get dependence.
I was wondering where that area was, because when you drink past that point, you're
walking. Right. Yeah, the vomit center runs on like substance P and glutamate. There's mostly, I think, substance P and glutamate receptors there. So, basically, why do we take drugs? It's because it literally makes you feel good. Schuster, by the way, showed that rats would work for drugs not causing withdrawal, so stimulants. And that, so that what that means is rats work for drugs without any dependence. Small amounts of stimulant, which aren't enough to produce dependence, in other words, withdrawal symptoms. But they'll still work for it. They'll still, in fact, devote their life, their little bar-pressing life, to getting amphetamine injected into their brain. But they don't get withdrawal. So you can't get them to take things orally. So sometimes it's been, that's one of the reasons I think this took so long. Pickens and Thompson in 1968, in fact, even found that drug use followed the laws of learning. I am not going into that. There's a whole course on what the laws of learning are in the fall. It's called 3306. So it's a whole course, and I'm not going to summarize a course in 3 minutes. But what I'm saying is that it's just a reinforcer. The thing is, we normally reinforcement, you know, supports behavior. So, for example, if I give you food after you do something, you'll keep doing it, whatever it may be. And it feels good to eat food. These things tend to make you feel good directly. They work right on, say, the accumbens. And you'll see this all the time. I'm going to say, where are the receptors for this drug? Oh, nucleus accumbens. So am I saying it's just conditioning drug taking? Yes, I am. That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying it's no different than having a rat peck a little lighted, rat peck A pigeon peck a little lighted disc, or a rat push a little bar. It explains the paradox of positive and negative effects of drugs, too. You drink alcohol to excess, you will not feel well the next morning, but it feels good when you're doing it. Right? So it feels good when you're doing it, and of course, learning works this way. The immediate consequences are what you pay attention to, not the long-term consequences, right? How many times have you woke up in the morning drunk? Not drunk, hungover. Drunk, waking up drunk's bad. Woken up hungover and say, I'm never drinking again. I'm just never drinking again. I can't believe I did that. Yeah, exactly. 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock rolls around. Someone texts you. Someone sends you a Facebook message. Someone maybe phones you. People still use phones. You want to go out? We're going drinking. Oh, okay. Because the immediate consequence of the alcohol, it feels good. Immediate consequence, taking heroin feels good. Feels really good, apparently. The choice of taking drugs actually depends on other available reinforcers. So this also explains, for example, why people with lower socioeconomic status have more drug problems. They have fewer things in their lives that are reinforcing. Okay? It actually follows something called the matching law, which the matching law just says that if you have two reinforcers that have the value 10 and let's say 5, this, if the bird pecks here, he gets 10 food pellets. If he pecks here, he gets 5 food pellets. The way that the birds, in this case, these are going to be birds, would distribute their behavior is they'd peck twice as many times here as they do here. They match the reinforcement density. Well, we can do that with effective ED50s of drugs and rats or monkeys, and they will do exactly the same thing. It's basically just learning. It's simply classical and operant conditioning. All right. We'll talk about classification of drugs. We'll take a little break because my voice will go in the second half if I don't do that. And then we'll talk about various drugs. So here's some, this is what we're going to talk about a little bit on each of these. Sedative hypnotics, alcohol, antipsychotic drugs, antidepressant drugs, narcotic analgesics, psychomotor stimulants, just like your cocaine, stuff like that, nicotine, caffeine, hallucinogens like LSD and stuff, and marijuana, which is, we can talk about pretty much on its own because it's pretty much its own classification of drug as well. All right, let's take 10 minutes and we will reconvene in 10 minutes and we'll talk about a bunch of drugs. Both want to beat each other, don't you? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. What'd you get? What'd you get? You do that, don't you? I had a friend like that as an undergrad, Pete. He used to drive me crazy. What'd you get, Dave? What'd you get? I'm not doing this for you, Pete. All right. So let's talk about some specific drugs, and then we'll talk a bit about hormones at the end. How do sedatives work? Okay, sedatives, I'm talking here about things like benzodiazepines and barbiturates. These are things like Valium, phenobarbital, things like that. So how do they work? What they do is they modify the effects of GABA. Remember, GABA is the universally inhibitory neurotransmitter. No worries. GABA, and we talked about this, in fact, in my lovely diagram is on my blog that I drew up with the chlorine getting into those dendrites. GABA lets chlorine in, which makes the charge more negative, so you get this inhibitory postsynaptic potential. They're positive GABA modulators. So they aren't actually the same sort of shape as a neurotransmitter, but they make the neurotransmitter work better. They make GABA more effective. Barbiturates, by the way, unlike benzodiazepines, barbiturates are things like phenobarbital. A benzodiazepine is like diazepam, Valium. Barbiturates at a high enough dose can actually open an ion channel by themselves. And here's how it works. There's a receptor. Okay, there's a receptor complex. So this GABA receptor here, and there's a benzodiazepine receptor. Okay? And there's the chlorine ion channel right there. So what happens here, the dashed line on this diagram means that it's going to make this GABA receptor more work better, basically, and open the ion channel more quickly. Okay? The dashed line pointing right to the ion channel says, in fact, barbiturates can open a chlorine ion channel all by themselves. Okay? So that's basically how they work. They alter the effects of GABA. GABA slows you down. It makes neurons harder to fire. So really, that's actually a pretty straightforward drug, isn't it? Pretty straightforward. They're just going to modify the effect of GABA. They're going to make GABA work better. All right. Does that make sense? Yeah.
So the benzodiazepine receptor gets stimulated, then it stimulates the GABA receptor to open.
Yes, sir. Sorry. No, not exactly. It makes it more attractive to GABA.
More attractive, like there's less GABA needed to open it?
Yes, sir. In the large scheme of things, you'd need one molecule of GABA to open that. But it's going to make it attract the GABA more quickly.
Yep. Would that cause reuptake?
Let me think.
No.
Because the reason why I said that is because there's more with... Because with GABA coming in, it doesn't need to...
You still need one GABA molecule to bind to one GABA binding site, one molecule. But in the larger scheme of things, you need less GABA because it gets more of an attraction to GABA. Does that make sense? So if I gave you, I'm just making up numbers here. I was going to say 5 milligrams. Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Yeah, sir.
I was just going to say, Bruce. Once a GABA, wouldn't that just produce more receptors for the GABA?
Oh, over a long period of time, yes. You'd actually end up making more GABA receptors, yeah. Fewer GABA receptors if you're taking benzodiazepines. Because your body's always trying to sort of balance everything out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But what's going to happen, Rob, is that it becomes... Think of it like a magnet. Let's think of that as an analogy. More powerful magnet attracts iron filings more quickly. It's basically making the receptors more attractive to the GABA. But it's still the case that one GABA molecule opens the ion channel. Yeah. Okay. Alcohol. I don't know how it works. Well, there's some ideas. It depresses the function of the ion channel and glutamate receptors. Okay, if that's the case... And glutamate is always a positive, like an excitatory neurotransmitter. You can see what it's going to do is slow down. So it's going to slow you down. That makes some sense then. The brain sort of adjusts after chronic use, right? Which ends up that you end up with more glutamate receptors, which might actually explain hallucinations and the DTs, things like that. The really nasty withdrawal symptoms from alcohol that I hope nobody in this room's ever had, but you might have if you're an alcoholic, or you might know somebody that's had this, where they actually literally see, they hallucinate, and the DTs, delirium tremens, where you actually feel like there's bugs crawling up your skin. That's probably, this might explain that, because it's a whole bunch of stimulation. There's an alcohol antagonist called RO-15-45-13, and it seems to work, and it works rather... on the ion channels of glutamate receptors. So it looks like it's to do with glutamate. It's probably also something to do with GABA alcohol. By the way, this antagonist, it's not like James Bond where he just takes the pill and then he can drink as many vodka martinis, shaken, not stirred, and not get drunk. No, no, no. Because you're thinking, oh boy, I can drink a whole bottle and get drunk. No, it's not like that. And this also isn't that antabuse stuff that just makes you sick immediately when you take a drink of alcohol, which is a treatment that's been used for alcohol, people with alcohol problems. you take this drug, and then every time you take it, literally a sip of alcohol, you get throwing up sick. What that basically does, if I'm not mistaken, is that one of the enzymes, it stops part of the metabolic pathway, and it turns a whole lot of the alcohol you ingest into formaldehyde, which makes you ill very quickly. So, of course, the way off that, you just don't take the pills anymore. So, it's not really a very effective treatment. It ain't no alcohol patch, yeah. Remember when Krusty the Clown was on the nicotine patch and he was licking them? Come on, kid, there's part of my butt that doesn't have a patch on it. Put it on there. Okay, so you know, we don't really understand how alcohol works. Alcohol, by the way, is a weird drug. All the rest of these drugs, how do they work? They have a half-life and all that stuff. Alcohol doesn't work with that kind of excretion. It actually is constant. I don't know why it works that like that and every other drug doesn't. Well, it's because of the way the metabolism works. That's beside the point. It's weird alcohol. It's a very, very strange drug. It's a very strange drug. Which is also why, for example, you can, the next morning after you've been drinking and you don't feel any effects anymore, you still probably ought not to be driving a car, because it's still going to have some behavioral effects on you. Antipsychotic drugs. Antipsychotic drugs are drugs that, for psychotic symptoms, schizophrenia. They block dopamine receptors. This one's great. I know exactly how these work. Antipsychotic drugs, so basically what's schizophrenia? Schizophrenia, hearing voices, paranoia, hallucinations, delusions of grandeur. You know, the thing, if you don't know about this, basically, and this is not meant to be callous, it's crazy. When you see people that are walking down the street, screaming at the top of their lungs, then you go, boy, that's crazy. That's schizophrenia. Right? And I'm not trying to be callous. I'm trying to say, if you've never seen schizophrenia before, that's what it looks like. It's not pleasant. It's exceedingly disturbing to be around a schizophrenic, actually. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And it's a horrible thing. Happily, these drugs a lot of times can control us. What they do is antipsychotic drugs block dopamine receptors. Specifically, a certain kind of dopamine receptor, a certain class called the D2 receptor. In fact, there's a direct relationship between the effectiveness of antipsychotic drugs and their binding to D2 receptors. The correlation is almost 1.00. If you were to draw a line and put ED50 for the drug and D2 binding affinity on the other axis, you get a straight line. That should tell you something. It should tell you that it's a dopamine problem, and it's not because someone labeled them. Oh, it's just labeling. Schizophrenia is just labeling. It's all a social construct. No, it's not. No, it's not. No, it's not. This wouldn't be like that if it was some social construct. It's too bad it isn't a social construct. Then we could stop doing it. And also, these drugs also tend to block acetylcholine, serotonin, and histamine. In fact, the first antipsychotic drugs that had a little bit of effect was the use of antihistamines. Really, really powerful antihistamines. So, in fact, you had a bunch of schizophrenics that had a little bit of, you know, lessening of their symptoms, but they didn't have stuffed up noses anymore. It's an antihistamine joke. There's so few of them. They do alter GABA and other peptides as well. And they block norepinephrine receptors and cause an increase in norepinephrine synthesis. That seems like a wash out there. The key thing, though, is it's about what they do to dopamine binding. Because schizophrenia is pretty clearly too much dopamine.
Too much dopamine.
Yeah, way too much.
The reward system is in the hot, happy streak.
Yeah, the reward system's always on. So everything that you do gets rewarded.
Doesn't dopamine give you euphoric feelings of, you know, hey, everything's great?
In the nucleus accumbens, it does, yeah.
Yeah. So
does all kinds of other stuff too, yeah.
Schizophrenia, they're having paranoid delusions, thoughts, whatever. So you take away dopamine, which gives a positive feeling, and they normalize?
No, they don't get, that's the problem. It's hard to get people to stay on those drugs because it takes all the fun out of life.
Well, I had a friend go through this just as
sure. Yeah.
And it was crazy.
No, it's a horrible thing to see, yeah.
Yeah, when somebody you've known your whole life.
Yep.
Just,
Lipsis. Yeah, exactly. And it happens in early 20s, typically late teens.
Because she hit her head off a bus and caused contemporary schizophrenia, apparently.
Wow.
Yeah. But anyways, like, she's fine. She's good now.
Good.
That
would be something different because if there was a head injury. That's we're not talking about a head injury here.
Okay, let's say I still have hardcore schizophrenia.
Yeah.
Taking dopamine and create this positive thought process.
Well, it's not that. It's that, think of it this way. If everything you think gets reinforced... Right, everything gets reinforced because remember the dopamine operates the reward system. If everything you ever think gets reinforced, we all have really crazy thoughts, right? Silly thoughts, stupid things. Now and then, I think things like, "I wish I was actually in Battlestar Galactica, flying a Viper and killing Cylons," because I'm a sci-fi geek. So those things come to mind now and then. Those things come to mind, but I get reinforced for thinking that. I get reinforced for everything I do.
Why? Because your thoughts will lead to produced different hormones.
Well, no, because everything I do, my reward system is constantly being constantly activated because I have too much dopamine. Yeah. So everything I do gets reinforced. So it's a problem with dopamine. I mean, it's not a good thing to have too much. Yeah, everything in moderation, including dopamine. the problem is, as I said, keeping people on these drugs very hard because, you know, your reward system runs on dopamine. If I take away the fact that food tastes any good anymore, and it's not the physiological way your taste buds work, it's the fact that the taste makes you feel good, the reinforcing part of it, that's gone. You lose interest in everything. It's hard to keep people on these drugs.
Was dopamine psychoactive?
By definition, it's a neurotransmitter. I think it does. I mean, this is the sort of thinking behind all this stuff, is that thoughts get disorganized and all this stuff because, frankly, everything's getting... Oh, yeah, that's great, that's great, that's great, that's great, that's great.
So their whole brain's lit up, right?
I wouldn't know about if I would say that's true. Oh, there's that graph. Isn't that pretty? Look, average dose for controlling schizophrenia... binding to a dopamine receptor. I guess I got another email. I get so many emails all the time. Wow. Isn't that nice? So the better the drug works, the better it binds to dopamine. It seems pretty clear that it's a dopamine issue. Okay. Key brain regions involved here. Oh, that's the reward system, that mesolimbic dopamine system. That's that... accumbens, ventral tegmental, and medial forebrain bundle circuit. The nigrostriatal system, which is important in smooth movement. Atypical antipsychotics have less effect in this area. There's two kinds of antipsychotic drugs. There's typical antipsychotics, and there's atypical ones. The atypical ones don't seem to have as many of the bad side effects. And they also seem to work on a different class of symptoms, not just the hallucinations and stuff, but the withdrawal, the sort of social withdrawal. The atypicals seem to have less effect in this area. They leave more dopamine available there. This is, in fact, if you don't have enough dopamine in the nigrostriatal system, you end up with Parkinson's disease. So you can get Parkinson's-like symptoms from too much antipsychotic drug. And in fact, this happened to a lot of people when the antipsychotic drugs first came out in the 50s. Dose is too high, they suddenly have what looks like Parkinson's. It's not Parkinson's, but it looks exactly the same. So, and also drugs that block cholinergic receptors stop Parkinson's symptoms, and so do atypical antipsychotic drugs. So this is probably how the new second generation of antipsychotic drugs is probably how they're working. This is what they seem to be doing. All right. Antidepressants. I'm just going to say this, and then I'll explain how these are obvious. Okay. There are three classes of antipsychotic drugs. There are monoamine oxidase inhibitors, MAOIs. Do not take as if you were taking MAOIs. Tricyclic antidepressants and selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. That's from people that live in serotonin. They're the serotonians. Hi, my name's Sarah. Serotonin, what's yours? Nora. Norepinephrine. So, there are very few neurotransmitter jokes. Okay, Monoamines. Oh, monoamines. That's like, you know, epinephrine, norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, right? Remember that? Okay. Now, again, this is where the biology students might have a little up on the psychology students, but we did talk about enzymes. Anything that ends in A's is an enzyme. A-S-E. Monoamine oxidase breaks down monoamines. Monoamines are things like dopamine, norepinephrine, epinephrine, serotonin. Okay. Monoamine oxidase breaks these things down. We need that. It's a digestive enzyme. We need it. We eat food. Sometimes you're eating delicious, delicious neurotransmitters. Okay. Now, if I block, inhibit, monoamine oxidase, now, not as much monoamine gets broken down, so there's more available. The idea with depression is maybe it's got something to do with monoamines. Not enough. So what this does is it indirectly makes more monoamines available in the nervous system. So you got monoamine oxidase, it gets, which would normally break down monoamines. But depressed people, maybe, don't have enough monoamines. So what do? We'll block the thing that breaks down the monoamines. Now, tricyclic antidepressants actually just block reuptake of monoamines. They do the same thing, except they don't do it with that extra step. They block reuptake. So instead of it going back up into the original neuron, it's just still floating around. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, you should be able to figure out how they work by their name. They selectively block the reuptake of serotonin. That's like your Prozac right there. That's how they work. These things are all making serotonin, more serotonin available. These two are making all monoamines, more monoamines available. There's also other ones out now that are looking right at dopamine. Other, yeah.
What the hell is the TCA stand for?
Tricyclic antidepressant. Yeah, sorry. The effects of these, by the way, the neurochemical effects, immediate, happen right away. The antidepressant effects take days, weeks, and in some people, more than a month. This is one of those things that makes you go, Because it's obviously not quite that simple. See, with antipsychotic drugs, if you're schizophrenic and I give you antipsychotics, it goes away. It's like the hallucinations go. If you're depressed and I give you Prozac, it takes a few weeks before it works. And that tells me that it's not just something about serotonin or monoamines. There's something else chemically going on. We don't know yet. Yeah.
Hey, has something to do with neurogenesis?
You think everything has something to do with the neurogenesis, though, Kirk? He does. He does. We talk about this all the time. How so?
That's why it takes so long, because it stimulates neurogenesis in parts of the brain.
You got that paper? I'd like to read it.
I could look for it.
Yeah, if you could find it. I mean, don't go your way, but if you could find it, I'd like to read that, because I haven't read that. Because this is a mystery to me, so I'd like to know.
Yeah, I can definitely find it. I don't think it would be hard to find either.
Okay. No, I'd like to know that, because, I mean, I guess that's possible. The other thing is the effectiveness of these things isn't like it is, say, with, again, an antipsychotic, which is they work.
I always thought it was because it had
built a therapeutic level. Yeah, but I mean, but the effect actually in the nervous system happens right away. It happens right away. If I give you right now, if I give you Prozac, there'd be more serotonin in your body in 30 minutes.
But it's not as good.
Yeah, I know. It's all neurogenesis, Kirk. I know. You're a neurogenesis freak. You think it's your thing. It's all you care about. I mean, it's a good thing to care about. New neurons in the central nervous system is a cool thing. Don't misunderstand me. Lithium chloride is given for the bipolar affective disorder, right? So that's manic depression, you might hear it called that. So the depression, you give these. The manic, you give lithium. Good thing, these expensive, this very cheap. It's lithium chloride, it's a salt of lithium. Because you wouldn't want to be given solid hunks of lithium for somebody to swallow. Because it would light your mouth on fire. literally. Yeah. You ever did that in chemistry in high school? You take a piece of lithium or a piece of sodium and drop it in water? Did you guys do anything in high school? Did they have any fun in science classes? You ever break a thermometer and play with the mercury? I'm not saying it's good for you, but you must have done that, right? We all did that.
In the doctor's office, pump it up until it comes out.
I wouldn't do it in a doctor's office. That's just, yeah, that's great. Put a deadly neurotoxin and just have it rolling around. And,
in a doctor's office.
Lithium, we don't really know how that works. It works, we just don't know how. Interesting, though, got to be careful. Therapeutic index, around 3. Take 3 times as many, and you die of the little lithium chlorine capsules. So do, if you are on lithium, which is quite possible some in this room is, the doctor probably said, only take this many and get your blood work done every week. And also probably, I hope, said to you, if you miss one, don't take 2. It's not that kind of drug. Okay, opiates. Opiates are great. Opiates are like, codeine and morphine. So they got receptors, because remember, we got endogenous or opiates, endorphins. There are 3 or 4 types. There's the mu receptor. This is throughout the limbic system, in the hippocampus and the amygdala. So this might explain the effects on memory and emotion when people take heroin. The thalamus and the locus coeruleus. Oh, the thalamus is about sensation, and that's about vision. Oh, very good. So again, we're explaining perhaps some of the interesting effects of things like morphine and codeine here. When I say interesting effects here, I'm talking about the sort of, I feel like I'm floating. I feel like I'm, many people here have probably had morphine after surgery or something like that. And you know there's that weird kind of almost out-of-body experience. Never taken morphine. I've taken codeine. Tylenol 3s, baby. Twisted my ankle. Nothing better. Best ankle twist I ever had. They have a weak attraction, which means the effect in the system's pretty great. So, which that's just a technical term. What I'm saying here is this receptor loves codeine and morphine. The delta receptor, the limbic system too, but they don't overlap with the mu. In the cortex, oh, look, reasoning. Hypothalamus, people get the shakes when they take codeine, morphine. They also, when they're going off with withdrawal symptoms, might feel hot flashes and get goosebumps. Right? That's where the term cold turkey comes from, actually. Well, that, we know what that does, right? Thermoregulation. The reward system. The medulla, it's going to affect sleeping, wakefulness. Also, a lot of antipsychotic drugs work on delta receptors. What else? There's a kappa receptor. Oh, look, it comes again. The ventral tegmental area. Oh, that's 2 parts of the reward system. Hypothalamus again. Thalamus again. And then there's the sigma receptor, which isn't really just an opioid receptor. And stimulation of sigma receptors leads to psychotic symptoms. So it's pretty obvious how these things are working. The key things here, you think about things like hypothalamus and thalamus, sensation effects on thalamus, hypothalamus, things like temperature control. And if you ever seen the movie Trainspotting, when they're going through withdrawal, and you know they got the sweats, then the shakes, things like that. Well, temperature control. Sensory effects, rewarding. The periaqueductal gray is full of opiate receptors, and these are when you're in pain, they're stimulated. This is where the pain killing comes from. The amygdala, as I mentioned, emotion. Also, your respiratory, cough, and vomit centers, those are down close to your... my handy-dandy diagram. Right around there, right in the brainstem. You actually have a vomit center, so if I stimulate your vomit center, you will puke. I'd have to drill a hole right down, so I'm not going to do it, because you'd probably be already puking from the drill. And of course, as I said, the reward system. As I mentioned here, there has to be some good reason to put a needle in your arm. Right? And again, this is almost immediate. The rush you get here, because you're doing an IV, it's hitting your reward system right away. I don't know if anybody here's ever seen somebody take heroin. I have, and I haven't taken heroin. I've seen somebody take heroin. And it looks like it's a lot of fun when they're taking it, because they go, like they just, and I've heard people describe it as a 45-minute body orgasm. That sounds pretty good. Sounds like we probably should go get some. Right? I mean, there's got to be, that's why you do something that stupid. Right? There's coke. I'm not talking about caffeine here. I'm talking about cocaine. That's right. Look at this. Cocaine toothpaste drops for your child. Because cocaine, anything ending in ane, is also a local anesthetic. So if you have some cocaine around the house and you have a toothache, right on the tooth. This is why, if you've ever seen, the movie Blow, when Bobcat Goldthwait snorts the cocaine and goes, "My whole face is numb." That's good coke. Coca-Cola, by the way, originally did have cocaine in it a long time ago. Coca leaves. Not anymore. Well, it's very, Red Bull has cocaine in it, but it's such a small amount because of the coca. It's vanishingly small. You would have to drink, I worked this out one day. You'd have to drink, I think, to get any effect at all, you'd have to all at once drink 800 cans of Red Bull. And by then you'd have to pee so much and all the caffeine, you'd be, the cocaine effect would really be minuscule, it'd be almost like a depressant at that point. But it was banned in Germany because they said, "That's cocaine enough!" But that's my German guy just yelling. "You'll tell us why the cocaine isn't the Red Bull." Turns out, there's hardly any, All right. So, things like cocaine. Cocaine and amphetamines, methamphetamine, in general, so that's your psychomotor stimulants. They often cause a leakage of transmitters, just spontaneous leakage. Like, it sounds gross, doesn't it? Of catecholamines, dopamine, epinephrine, norepinephrine, and serotonin. And increasing the amount released of ecstasy does this solely with, so they're agonists, but solely with serotonin. Ecstasy is a weird drug because it's also a hallucinogenic, but it is a stimulant at the same time. No, you're thinking of HGH. 5-HT is serotonin. Cocaine blocks reuptake of dopamine. That's all cocaine does. Put these all together because they all have the same effects on your body, and so, in effect, they're pretty much indistinguishable from each other when taken. In the peripheral nervous system, you get epinephrine being released, so out in the rest of your body. This is why these are performance-enhancing drugs. They can't be taken for, like, Olympic competition. Right? It's also why you can't take... When hockey players go to the Olympics, they don't take Sudafeds anymore. Because Sudafed releases is a fluacetoephedrine, which is an decongestant. But it's also a stimulant. And, one or two is okay, but a whole pack of Sudafeds, NHL players do that all the time. And their excuse is, "Well, I get a lot of colds because I'm on the ice, eh?" No, it's because it's a stimulant. That's Don Cherry defending it one day, saying that they get a lot of colds because they play on ice. It's like, you can sit in shirt sleeves even in the SR Center. I mean, it's not like it's cold in arenas. Especially this time of year, right? So that's how those work. It's pretty clear, just more catecholamines. Caffeine's kind of a funny drug. We don't really know how this one works either, and it's legal. It seems like all the legal drugs, we don't really know how they work. This might block adenosine. Looks like it does, which is a neuromodulator. Modulator that inhibits firing. So what caffeine does is it disinhibits. It stops inhibition. High doses, by the way, of caffeine can block one of those benzodiazepine receptors. High doses will not do anything about alcohol, but if you're taking benzodiazepines, you could try to take a lot of coffee. But it's not. I'm talking like 800 grams. So like 8 cups of coffee. In other words, don't do this. Don't think I'll take a lot, then I'll just drink a lot of coffee. Dave said it's okay. It's not what I said. I don't want to be sued. So, oh, by the way, caffeine, interesting caffeine fact. Probably the safest psychoactive drug, also probably almost certainly the most used psychoactive drug. About 190 million or so North American adults are dependent on caffeine. In other words, they wake up with caffeine withdrawal, which includes having like a bit of a stuffy nose. If you have any of these, and then it goes away after you have a coffee. Or even start making a sip of coffee. We can discriminate between 2 milligrams of caffeine and no milligrams of caffeine. Humans are amazing. Okay. Joints a little bit stiff, a little sore, stuffy nose, a little irritable, a little bit of coffee and you're fine. Oh, headache. You are dependent on caffeine, you junkie. It's safe. I wouldn't worry. You can overdose on caffeine. It is possible. It is possible. You need to take about... I think it's 8,000 milligrams. So it's 80 cups of coffee. So I wouldn't worry at once. You can do it with pills. But caffeine's really pretty safe. And it's even safe. Pregnant women can drink caffeine, drink coffee, you know, it's no big deal. Right. Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Because the thing is about adults, we, 30-minute half-life, it's gone. It's great. We're great at it. Kids. You get kids under the age of maybe, especially little kids. Okay, so we're talking less than, say, 5. The half-life is 3.5 days. Don't give little kids Coca-Cola. It's stupid. When I see parents, and I don't tell parents what to do unless they're hitting their kids or putting them down, because I will do that. Say things like, oh, you're really a tough guy. Hey, hit your kid. Way to go. Want to fight me? Pick on somebody your own size? But you see, you ever see a parent and they got like a 3-year-old and they're at McDonald's and they give them a Coke? It's a very, very bad idea. Because they'll be paying for that for a long time. There's probably 30 milligrams of caffeine in there. And for you and me, 30 milligrams of caffeine wouldn't do much to us. In half an hour, we only have 15 milligrams. You know, it'll be gone. Little kid, in 3.5 days, you're still 15 milligrams. It's your own funeral, dude, if you want to give your kid... The other thing is chocolate. See, this is a horrible thing. You know, people always say at Easter, oh, it's all just the it's the sugar. It's not the sugar. It's the caffeine in the chocolate.
What's the half-life on that?
It doesn't work the same way, though. Stephanie knows a lot about sugar. She wrote a paper for me.
No,
it doesn't really work that way. It's not absorbed like that. It's constant, isn't it? Because it's a food, eh? Yeah. Yep. So just don't give little kids a lot of... I'm not saying, look, your kid's 3 and you want to give him an Easter bunny chocolate. That's great. All I'm saying is the kid's going to be awake. Just keep it in mind. When your mom said you were too young for coffee when you were little and said, can I have some coffee? Oh, you're too small. Your mom was right. Intuitively, she knew the half-life of caffeine in you was like 3.5 days. Adults, you're fine. Don't worry. Nicotine. There are nicotine receptors in the following areas. The cortex. Well, smokers do report it focuses them. The basal ganglia. We're getting close. We're sort of going between the cortex and we're getting to the limbic system here. Well, that's connections from sort of emotion, memory, things like that up to cortex. That's okay. Oh, look, the reward system. Why do you think people smoke cigarettes? Besides the fact that it looks cool, everybody's doing it, and it makes you grown up. Those were jokes. Nobody. Anyway, Austin God. I always want to call you Kent Austin. It drives me crazy. Austin. No one else in the room probably knows who Kent Austin is, but see, his name's Austin Kent. There was a quarterback who played in the CFL named Kent Austin. Anyway. It's the funniest thing on the class list because it's listed last name, first name. It's like, dude, what about Doug Flutie? Is he in the class? You know. So that's the reward system right here. That's why people smoke cigarettes. Because it feels good to smoke cigarettes. As my dad used to say, even after he quit smoking, I don't care what the hell anybody says, cigarettes just effing taste good. All right. Effects of nicotine, peripheral nervous system effects, you get tremors. So a lot of times after a smoker has a cigarette, you'll see they can't hold their hand straight. I can. I haven't had a cigarette. Inhibition. It's kind of weird. Well, you're actually getting disinhibition because it's a stimulant. You get constriction of blood vessels. Smokers oftentimes have cold extremities. You can always tell, very often you can tell if you shake hands with somebody if they're a smoker because their hands are colder. Oh, those are two different things, though. It constricts the blood vessels, but that's just a momentary thing. You're thinking about like heart disease, basically. Yeah.
If someone's been exposed to secondhand smoke, for a long time, they exhibit some of this.
Secondhand smoke is probably not as dangerous as it's made out to be.
But like stuff like that.
You'd have to be really. The thing is, the amount. The temperature that the nicotine burns at, so the tobacco burns at, when it's ingested, like when you're sucking on it, is much hotter, and you get a lot more nicotine than you do from environmental smoke. The effects of secondhand smoke are more likely from the tar, the shit in the smoke, rather than they are from the nicotine itself. The amount of nicotine that you're going to be ingesting, that you'll be inhaling, even in a crowded, back in the day, bar that had smoke in the room, it's not enough to make you feel like you're actually smoking a cigarette. Yeah, but I'm not saying it's good for you, or it's probably even neutral, but it's probably not nearly as bad for you as it's made out to be. This has become sort of a political thing, which is a shame. The data aren't nearly as clear as they made out to be, you know. And I'm all for smoking bans all over the place. I think they're great. But it's just not nearly the clear thing that it's been made out to be. Yeah. But any effects there are not going to be nicotine effects. They're going to be effects of, you know, just like sitting around a campfire and sucking in all that crap, you know. Oh, yeah, it smells good, though. Unlike cigarettes, it smells horrible. There are CNS effects, too, of course, reward system. The release of norepinephrine, epinephrine, dopamine, and serotonin. It's a stimulant. Nicotine's a stimulant. If you have trouble sleeping and you're a smoker, you should try to stop smoking around 10 o'clock at night kind of thing so you can try to get some sleep. Just stop smoking in general. If it's a stimulant, why do people smoke to relax? Right? Because people do. People like, I'm nervous, I need a cigarette. And it calms them. And there's data on this and you can measure it. It's a real effect. This is called Nesbitt's paradox. Which bugs me because it's like he just took something obvious and put his name on it. Hey, you ever noticed smokers smoke to relax? That's a paradox. I'm not the first person to say it, but I'm going to be the first guy to write it down, and my name's Nesbitt. That's Nesbitt's paradox. You ever notice that people name anything after themselves? That's Brodbeck's paradox. Anyway. Why do people do that, though? Is it the physical act of smoking? Is it somehow calming? You know, it's just distracting. Right? Maybe it's that. Is it withdrawal? Maybe it's just getting rid of withdrawal symptoms. That's actually quite nice, and it's conceivable. Nicotine withdrawal is a really long-lasting withdrawal. Cravings can last 10 or 15 years in people who quit smoking. They still want to smoke. You know? Oh, here's a better one. I bet it's due to the nicotine receptors in the GABA system. That's probably what it is. And GABA is inhibitory. So nicotine's a weird drug because it's excitatory and inhibitory at the same time. This was neat. I didn't even know. I remember making up a nicotine lecture ages ago, and I was at a conference, and I had my computer with me, and my friend Duncan said, let's go to this talk. It's about evolutionary psychology. You're into that, and I'm a social psychologist. It's about evolutionary social psychology. And I said, okay, yeah, I'll go to that. I walk in, and he said, I think we're in the wrong room. I said, shut up. This is cool. And it was when the guy said, you know, I've just found this nicotine receptor in the GABA system. So I was pretty excited about that. Okay, what about hallucinogenics? Well, LSD is basically like serotonin. It's got about a 110-minute half-life. Magic mushrooms are pretty similar to this, by the way, psilocybin. This is what Timothy Leary started out with these. You know, Timothy Leary, the guy, the professor from Harvard, that even tenured professors can get fired when they hand out magic mushrooms to their classes. Yeah, that gets you in trouble. Yeah, believe me. There's a lot of things I could do and nothing happens to me. But if I'm handing out illegal drugs to the class, that could get me in some trouble. Here's some other ones that are interesting, and they also are like serotonin. Morning glory seeds. Now you're all going to rush out to this to Canadian Tire and go, morning glory, morning glory. Harmine, which is just another one of these things. Bufotenin, which is toad licking. You ever heard about this? Australian toad licking? Yeah, licking Australian toads. Which people have done, apparently, but basically a paper came out that said this animal has a defense mechanism, and basically it secretes something like LSD. Some idiot in the media got a hold of it and said, see, that's a good defense, right? Because like most other animals, unlike humans, don't want to expand their perceptions, man. Right? So it's not like when a kangaroo is chasing this Australian toad, oh, suddenly I can see sound and hear color. That's an Australian kangaroo. That's what I was doing. This is great. I'm going to go lick some old toads. Of course not. They don't like it. It trains them to stay away. So this comes out, and then people, yeah, but people are licking toads. So some people did, but for the most part, you know, Australia is the most urbanized country in the world. It's easy to get LSD. You know, you can get acid, so nobody's really licking toads. I just thought I'd let you know. It's a real drug, though, you know, but you could also just go get some acid. I'm going to go all the way to Australia to lick toads. You really have a different set of goals than someone like, say, Magellan. Norepinephrine, acetylcholine, and other those like drugs like those. MDMA, ecstasy. STP, these are all things you don't see much anymore. Mescaline, a little bit. Nutmeg. If you ingest a lot of nutmeg, it's like acetylcholine. But again, that makes you a loser. Just letting you know, kids. It's probably more expensive, too, like you think about it. Because it's a lot of nutmeg you have to ingest here. Mandrake. Oh, cool. Deadly nightshade. I wouldn't take anything with the word deadly in it. It's just sort of a personal rule. Angel dust. So these are all basically, they're all hallucinogens. They aren't really fun drugs for the most part. That is, and that is. Special K, which is just basically horse tranquilizer. All right. Of course, then there's marijuana. Yeah. The weed from the devil's garden. These are propaganda posters from propaganda movies. They're darn funny. They're from the 1930s. If you get a chance, this is in the public domain. I believe you can get this at archive.org. Watch Reefer Madness. It's a propaganda movie against marijuana made by the U.S. Department of Education in 1937. It is a hoot. It's very funny. By the way, you ever been around a bunch of people smoking weed that have weird orgies and unleashed passions? I usually just see this. You know, I don't see people having orgies. Maybe I'm in the wrong crowd. I don't know. Okay, how did they find... This is a cool story. One group at NIMH in the States was looking at a cannabinoid, a synthetic cannabinoid, and they were trying to see where it would bind. And the other group, literally in the next lab, they found a gene that coded for a receptor site. And they turns out the maps match, so they said, hey, look, we found the receptor for THC, which is kind of cool. This is early 80s, 82, 83. Receptors to THC, cortex. Well, you have trouble with your reasoning there. Hippocampus, memory effects. Memory effects, this is why sometimes, and then this is, I forgot. Cerebellum, smooth movement, balance. Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny how I can... All the other drugs, people are going, okay, I got that. Marijuana, it's like, oh, I see. Because everybody's high. Basal ganglia, spinal cord. Oh, you know what? It's actually a nice little painkiller. Stops pain messages. Brainstem. Hypothalamus. Oh, gee, I wonder where the munchies come from. Spleen. That's the one that kills me. That's why there's an exclamation point. There are your spleen? Well, it's actually can act as a I always forget this word, and I always say antibacterial agent. Antibiotic. It's a wonder drug. All right. So some reasons about drugs. First of all, I say drugs are fun. That's why people take drugs, because they're rewarding. They operate your mesolimbic dopamine system. This is why people do it. And also, you know, ruin their lives. Damn it, kids, just say no. Because that's worked really well. Conditioning, the old conditioning model is a really good explanation here. The question you have to ask yourself is, can you handle the truth? Because, I mean, the thing is, these drugs all work the same way, in essence, all the fun ones. And they work by reinforcing you. So making one, and I'm going to make one little editorial comment, and then we'll talk about hormones. Making one illegal and one legal when they all do roughly the same thing in your brain seems a little bit silly, especially when you're making it a moral argument. If you want to make it into a, this is safer than this drug, that's fine. Let's ban alcohol. I'm just saying that that's the logical extension of that argument. Let's ban alcohol and we'll all just smoke weed all the time. Think of the economy. Think of the restaurants. You know, pizza places would be booming. Don't mix science and morality is basically the point you have to make here. Is that you can't put those two together. And it's hard with drugs because we do know drugs can ruin people's lives. All right. I never thought we'd get here, but finally, let's talk about hormones. Okay, basically, they're chemicals that target certain organs and brain regions. Typically, they work a lot like neurotransmitters, except usually outside the central nervous system. They're secreted by glands. They're homeostatic hormones. These are basically things trying to keep you at a... like things like insulin. Okay? Trying to keep your blood sugar constant. They're not that interesting as far as behavior. There's reproductive hormones. They're interesting for behavior because male sort of type behavior and female type behavior seem related to reproductive hormones. Things like testosterone, estrogen, estradiol. And then there's stress hormones. Those are interesting because that's when your autonomic nervous system kicks in. All right. The hypothalamus sends releasing factors to the pituitary, and the pituitary tells glands to release various hormones. This is works quite a bit more slowly than, you know, you think about like P300, which is, we'll talk about that when we talk about thinking. Then you think about the P300 wave in the brain is that, I mentioned this the other day, every time, all the words I'm saying, they feel like they're coming out of my mouth exactly when I thought they were going to, but actually I've probably had to have thought of them a little bit before that because it's not instantaneous in here. It's really slow in the autonomic nervous system because here we're talking about hormones. This can take 45 seconds, a minute, two minutes, 5 minutes for this to kick in, right? So like when you get into a car accident, like a near miss, not a car accident, but a near miss, you'll find that a minute later, your heart's beating fast, your mouth is dry, you can almost taste the sort of teeny taste of adrenaline in your mouth, your pupils are dilating, and nothing bad happened to you. Right? Because it takes a while for the stress hormone to get released. Hormones basically enter cells, they turn genes on. They enter cells, by the way, through receptors, the same way that neurotransmitters enter cells. Then, of course, genes make proteins, and we get changes. All right, sex hormones, a little bit on them. Testosterone contributes to the male spatial superiority on various tests. We know this by comparing males and females on various spatial kind of tests. The classic one here is the underhanded Nerf ball throwing with 45-degree angle shifting prisms, something no one's done before. Because anything else, you might say, oh, maybe females have experience with this, males don't, or males have experience and females don't. You have to find something that nobody's done before. So one that's often done is you just put these prisms on that shift the world over 45 degrees, and then you have to throw a ball underhand at a target. It's hard. But it's very spatially loaded, and men, on average, are better than women. It also does in rats, and I talked about this. We talked a little bit at the beginning of the course about how if I gave rats testosterone, female rats, they are better on mazes than females that haven't been given testosterone. Progesterone and estradiol, which are two female hormones, At low levels, females do better on spatial tasks. At higher levels, they don't do nearly as well, because they're more female-y. However, they do, the verbal superiority of females shows up more when they're given these hormones. And we don't tend to give them to them. You tend to take a blood sample and do a radiumean assay. And the other thing is you just also ask the woman, when was the last time you had your period? So you find out whether they're on their menstrual period. So you should, all women should be taking spelling tests based on where they are in their menstrual cycle. All right. I've talked a bit about that before, so I won't talk too much. A little bit about stress hormones. Stress is crazy. Because, now it serves a function, of course, right? Function is it keeps you alive if a saber-toothed tiger is coming after you. The function is it keeps you alive if you're in a fight. The function is it actually leads to a solution very often. The brain recognizes something as a stressor. And that something can be something as simple as having to stand in line at the store. You know, because somebody's buying lottery tickets, some innumerate jackass is buying lottery tickets. I hate lottery tickets. Could be playing a video game, but also could be something serious, like you could be in battle. Then you need epinephrine and cortisol. They're good. They get you really going. It's your autonomic nervous system. I want to be able to run if somebody's shooting at me. Epinephrine turns everything on, and the cortisol shuts you down. That's your parasympathetic. Cortisol levels are controlled by the hippocampus, which is interesting because it doesn't just do memory stuff. It also controls cortisol levels, and it monitors them. Too much cortisol damages the hippocampus. So too much stress, and this has to be a lot of stress. You must understand this, okay? Can actually lead to memory loss. Again, this is a lot of stress. This isn't like, oh, I have a few exams stress. But it does cause brain damage. It's an insidious thing. Good. You aren't more likely, you're more likely to remember traumatic experiences, actually. Yeah, you are. Yeah, there's no such thing as a repressed memory. You're more likely to remember traumatic experiences. You want to forget them. Sorry. This is, here we're talking about long-term.
Would traumatic be in the amygdala level?
Mm-hmm. And emotional memories are better remembered than non-emotional memories. Yeah. No, that's a myth that's out there. It's just not true. Okay. The kind of stress I'm talking about here, the level that's going to actually cause memory damage, obviously, is going to be like living in Leningrad in 1942 when the Germans are sieging Leningrad. I'm not talking about, oh, I got some exams. Right? Oh, I didn't do well on a test or something. Oh, my paper was rejected by that journal. You know, this is serious stress here. This is long term. This is you know, it might have something to do with that. But I mean, the thing about PTSD is it can show up in soldiers that have been in battle once, right? And it can show up in soldiers, and it doesn't also show up in soldiers that have been at war for years. It's a weird thing. I don't know enough about PTSD to really comment beyond that. And the other weird thing is that not enough people. To my mind, if I was ever in battle, I'd just have PTSD. Why doesn't everybody that comes out of a war, why isn't everybody completely screwed up? And everybody isn't. Weird. No, isn't it weird? I mean, people shooting at you, watching your friends get killed. I've been watching war movies. My wife goes away, I just watch war movies. It's awesome. Tonight, Tora, Tora, Tora. It's the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. It's a good movie. It's a great movie. Watched Midway last night. Anyway, that's enough of that. That's a good one, too. Charlton Heston. All right. I'm done. Right. So, on Monday, we'll talk about development, I think, and then test Wednesday. Thanks, guys.
something like that.
Podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright share alike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.